Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 265, titled Dracula for President Part 2, Forward into the Past. In part one of the broadcast, we reviewed information about Corneliu Tudor, who recently was defeated in the Romanian elections. He was running basically in second place, and he was favorably compared by his supporters not only to the Iron Guard fascist movement in Romania, but also, and this is where the title comes from, to Prince Vlad Tepes, or Vlad the Impaler, the inspiration for the Dracula legend. In part one of the broadcast, we reviewed some information about the Iron Guard, and specifically about a brutal pogrom that followed an unsuccessful revolt by the Iron Guard in Romania. That pogrom was led by Viorel Trifa, the leader of the Green Shirts, the youth movement of the Iron Guard. We then reviewed information about an illegal domestic intelligence operation called the Crusade for Freedom, which not only brought elements like the Iron Guard into the United States to serve as ethnic leaders in our Eastern European ethnic groups on behalf of the Republican Party, but also put them to work for U.S. intelligence, and ultimately this milieu coalesced formally into a wing of the Republican Party, and that coalescence was incorporated, or effected, when George Herbert Walker Bush was chairman of the Republican National Committee. The person who oversaw the Crusade for Freedom was Richard Nixon. He was acting in that capacity as a protege of Alan Dulles, former director of the CIA and key law partner in Sullivan and Cromwell. The chief spokesperson for this program was Ronald Reagan, and William Casey, Ronald Reagan's campaign manager in 1980 and later his CIA director, was the person who handled many of the State Department machinations with regard to the Crusade for Freedom. Among the elements brought into the United States under the auspices of the Crusade for Freedom was an entire SS intelligence unit, the Vorkommando Moscow, settled in the New York, New Jersey area complete and intact in order to counteract, quote, Jewish influence, unquote. What we're going to look at in this half of the program is we're going to review some information that we looked at in RFA 2, not only about Viorel, later Valerian Trifa's post-war career, but specifically we're going to take a look at how Viorel slash Valerian Trifa succeeded to his position as Archbishop of the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate. And in turn, we can extrapolate some lessons for the recently concluded American political election. For those people who don't think there are any major differences between the two political parties, just review the information you heard in this program and are about to hear, and basically check yourselves. Even if one didn't know anything about the issues in the year 2000, this alone is a rather profound difference. To make a very long story very short, the Republican Party, or the more venal elements thereof, kill and physically harass their opponents and critics. And they are very, very cozy indeed with international fascism. And there's an entire Nazi wing of the Republican Party. There is no such thing and no such heritage in the Democratic Party. Don't try telling that to Ralph Nader supporters, however. We're going to turn once again by way of taking a look at some of the political heritage that yielded the year 2000 election results. We're going to turn once again to a book that we looked at in the first half of the program. That book is entitled Wanted, The Search for Nazis in America. It was authored by Howard Blum, published in hardcover, that's B-L-U-M, published in hardcover by Quadrangle Books, that's a subsidiary of New York Times Book Company. Copyright 1977, the ISBN number is 0-8129-0607-1. What we're going to take a look at is the means by which Valerian Trifa, we're going to take a look at Valerian Trifa's post-war clerical career, and specifically we're going to take a look at his giving of the opening prayer, or leading of the opening prayer, before the United States Senate on May 11th of 1955. Turning now to Wanted, the Search for Nazis in America, we read, on Wednesday, May 11th of 1955, Bishop Trifa, and we're going to take a look at how he became Bishop Trifa in a minute, beginning again on Wednesday, May 11th of 1955, Bishop Trifa had the honor of offering the opening prayer before the United States Senate. Now, contrast this with his comments about Jews and about overturning the French Revolution and his venal comments that we quoted in Part 1. These comments were used to work up the crowd for the pogrom in 1941 in Bucharest. Beginning again, on Wednesday, May 11th, 1955, Bishop Trifa had the honor of offering the opening prayer before the U.S. Senate. Quote, Almighty God, who has made America trustee of priceless human liberty and dignity, look down from heaven upon thy servants now present before thee and bless them, that they may remember in their discussions and decisions Romania and all the oppressed nations who are still longing for, quote, a government by the people and for the people, unquote. Bishop Trefa's presence had been requested by Vice President Richard M. Nixon. At the time, Charlie Kramer, that's a former Romanian-American dentist who was investigating Trefa, at the time Kramer said, quote, if I had been in the country, they never would have let Trefa into the Senate or on Radio Free Europe, unquote. But years later, after the revelations of contemporary history, the dentist had become more cynical. He now believed J. Edgar Hoover had been aware of Trefa's past, but in the interests of anti-communism, was willing to make a practical alliance with an Iron Guard commandant. Just as the newly formed CIA quickly and expediently forgot past grudges to draft Nazi spy chief Reinhard Gehlen's agents, Hoover could have sought out and protected Trefa. Significantly, Kramer was to learn, following the collapse of the Antonescu regime in 1945, Trefa had worked in Vienna as an agent for Gehlen's spy network. And again, bear in mind Trefa's remarks before the U.S. Senate. Almighty God, who has made America trustee of priceless human liberty and dignity, look down from heaven upon thy servants now present before thee and bless them, that they may remember in their discussions and decisions Romania and all the oppressed nations who are still longing for, quote, a government by the people and for the people. Contrast that with his remarks helped fire up the crowd for the pogrom. And this is by way of review from the first part of the program. Let me review a paragraph up. This war started, Trefa began, with the French Revolution. The war he was talking about was World War II. The origin of the old world was these miraculous words, liberty, equality, and fraternity. These words liberated the people from one tyrant who had enslaved them and instead delivered them to hundreds of thousands of tyrants exploiting these principles. People were never equal, not even in the first days of the revolution. These ideas of equality served a category of people who enslaved others and profited by these confused ideas. These ideas of equality served the kikes, and the kikes of Europe have intensified their struggle for emancipation at the moment when the revolutionary spirit reached the Rhine, etc., etc. That, by way of review for people that might have missed the first half hour of the program, that reviewing Trefa's comments to the crowd that fired them up for the pogrom in which thousands of Jews were killed, and an unsuccessful attempt was made to overthrow the Romanian government. A number of Jews were taken and their corpses butchered and hung on meat hooks in the municipal slaughterhouse with a sign saying kosher meat. And again, that was led by Valerian Trefa. Now, that prayer before the opening Senate came because it was delivered, and bear in mind that Trefa was the invitee of then-Vice President Richard Nixon, who oversaw the crusade for freedom and was later president when his chairman of the Republican National Committee, George Bush, helped to incorporate this group as a permanent wing of the Republican Party. Trefa became head of the Romanian-American Orthodox Episcopate because the Bishop of the Romanian-American Orthodox Episcopate, Bishop Moldovan, had ultimately had to answer to the Romanian Orthodox Episcopate in Romania. And, of course, at this time, the time we're looking at, the early 1950s, Romania was under Soviet domination. Therefore, by extension, the Romanian-American Orthodox Episcopate was viewed as being somehow a communist collaborationist. We're going to take a look now at the brown shirt operation by which the Iron Guard associates of Valerian Trefa installed him, basically through naked strong arm brown shirt tactics, as head of the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate. Turning once again to Wanted the Search for Nazis in America, the gray farmhouse was surrounded by shouting men. A rock crashed through a window. Other stones slammed against the front door and roof. Stefan Ferraru, F-E-R-F-E-R-A-R-U, tried to call for help, but it was useless. The telephone lines had been cut. At least 100 men crowded the finely shaven green lawn stretching from the road to the main house. Most were just observers up from Detroit for a fine summer's day in the country. The crowd, though, had been drinking, and the alcohol and sun mixed to make them restless and aggressive. Many, waving their bottles in the air, started chanting in a tough, loud cadence, quote, communists. At the head of the lawn, directly in front of the farmhouse, was a more menacing group of approximately 30 men. They were neither drunk nor merely restless. They had planned the assault on the Romanian Orthodox Episcopate in Grass Lakes, Michigan, as if it were a military operation. First, the phone lines would be cut, a barrage of rocks, and then the final push, the seizure of the Vatra. That, by the way, was the compound in which the clerics lived. Continuing. In fact, many of these men were trained soldiers. They had been trained 20 years ago in Romania when they fought with the Iron Guard. These men, some brandishing broom handles, advanced toward the house. A priest's new Buick directly in their path became an easy target. Windows were smashed and tires slashed. Another volley of rocks was thrown as they moved closer. Inside the farmhouse, Bishop Moldovan and his priests began to panic. "We were scared," Stefan Ferraru remembered. "We had come to the Vatra a few days early to prepare for the annual church congress. We knew there would be some discussion, some debate, but we never expected an attack. These men were wild," unquote. Father Oprean, O-P-R-E-A-N, a short priest with a long gray beard, decided he could stop the assault. He believed no one would attack a priest dressed in his black cassock, a cross hanging from his neck. He walked out to the front porch and raised his arms, appealing for quiet. "Fellow Christians," he began. But before he could continue, he was dragged from the porch. Clutching the priest's beard, the attacker spun the priest as if he were a child's top into the crowd. Men surrounded the priest, pushing, punching, and kicking until Father Oprean fell to the ground. He lay dazed, a small, old man, his black cassock spread about the green grass like a discarded rag. Bishop Moldovan had no choice but surrender. If a battle were to be fought, he would have to wage it in an American court. On Independence Day, July 4th, 1952, he surrendered the 200-acre Vatra in northern Michigan to the priests and supporters of the newly chosen dissident bishop, Valerian Trifa. The Reverend Vasily Pascau, P-A-S-C-A-U, Bishop Moldovan's secretary, had been inside the farmhouse during the assault and later wrote, quote, "A group of Iron Guardist hoodlums invaded our property, beating an old priest, creating terror among our women, children, and old people, exactly as Hitler did once in Germany against the Jews. After this kind of ordeal, they took over our property by force, chasing us out," unquote. And later, in order to attempt to overturn this brown shirt action by the Iron Guard, which installed Valerian Trifa as head of the Romanian-American Orthodox Episcopate, ultimately, the priests turned to the courts, and they were unsuccessful. Note the following, and we're turning once again to Wanted, the Search for Nazis in America. The Vatra, which Trifa's supporters had taken by force, was now officially his. Bishop Moldovan's legal challenges were defeated. An Ohio district court, reaching its decision in the midst of the McCarthy era, decided, quote, "The communistic government of Romania was dictating appointment of its Bishop Moldovan, and the American diocese was entitled to revoke its 1936 bylaws and elect its own bishop, Trifa." And the takeover by force, a naked brown shirt action, and the subsequent refusal by the courts to provide justice to the priests of the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate is disturbingly like what we just saw in Florida, when basically a brown shirt action, and I think that is the only intelligent and fair assessment of the mob action to force the halt of a count of ballots, that particular mob action, that brown shirt action, which installed Bishop Trifa as head of the Romanian Orthodox Episcopate and which later was upheld by the courts, is disturbingly reminiscent of what we have seen in the year 2000 in Florida and on the national scene. It's one of the reasons why I went into the discussion about the Crusade for Freedom, the role of Bush, Reagan, Nixon, Dulles, Casey et al. In that, and its connections to elements of U.S. intelligence. We're going to turn now to the San Francisco Chronicle of November 28th of the year 2000. This is a column by John Carroll, a San Francisco Chronicle media critic. It's entitled, "See Foot, Shoot Same, and it deals with the mob action down in Florida. It was wearying, but it was necessary. Actually, let me begin again. Then came all the Florida stuff. It was wearying, but it was necessary. People thought, well, this is tedious, but there doesn't seem to be any other way to settle it. And, of course, the partisan people amped up the rhetoric. That's their job. Then came the brown shirts. In terms of public relations, there was really only one difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. The GOP had the brown shirts, and the Dems did not. That, by the way, can be taken in the most literal sense possible. That's one of the reasons I've gone into the history of some of these events in this particular broadcast. Continuing and repeating the last sentence, last couple of sentences, then came the brown shirts. In terms of public relations, there was really only one difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. The GOP had the brown shirts, and the Dems did not. There were mobs in Broward and Dade counties. There were cries of treason. There were hints of dark plots and black helicopters. All the thin-eyed people were back, bullying the innocent while invoking God. Does that sound like the Iron Guard revolt? Continuing. All the thin-eyed people were back, bullying the innocent while invoking God. The pictures on television carried their own message. On the one side, the public-spirited citizens who volunteered to serve on election boards, real ordinary folks in real low-profile jobs suddenly hurled into the spotlight. On the other side were the crazies, their level of rage barely contained. It was stunning. And I think that column pretty much speaks for itself about what took place in Florida. And research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience. A more substantive and eloquent assessment of the Republican brown shirt action in Florida was provided by Robert Perry and the Media Consortium. This was researched for us by a member of the listening audience. This comes from the Consortium for Independent Journalism, and this can be found on their website at www.consortiumnews.com. That's CONSORTIUMNEWS.com. And this was posted on Friday, November 24th, of the year 2000. It's titled, Mob Rule Wins for W, and it reads as follows. Texas Governor George W. Bush appears to have sealed his claim to the White House through a premeditated mob action that influenced the crucial Dade County decision to halt a recount. Egged on by Republican phone banks and heated rhetoric over Cuban American radio, a pro-Bush mob of about 150 people descended on the Dade County Canvassing Board Wednesday as it was preparing to evaluate 10,750 disputed ballots. Quote, Republican volunteers shouted into megaphones urging protest, the New York Times reported in today's editions, again quoting, a lawyer for the Republican Party helped stir ethnic passions by contending that the recount was biased against Hispanic voters, unquote. The protesters carried anti-Gore signs, including one that read, Rotten to the Gore, unquote. The demonstration then turned violent as the canvassing board sought to go into closed session to begin examining the ballots. Dade County's Democratic chairman, Joe Geller, was chased by the crowd and required police protection. The mob also charged the offices of the supervisor of elections and began pounding on the doors. Several people were roughed up before sheriff deputies blocked the demonstrators' path and restored some order. The shaken three-member canvassing board promptly reversed its decision to count the ballots that many observers believed contained a large number of uncounted votes for Vice President Al Gore. One canvassing board member, David Leahy, admitted that the board's decision to bail out on the recount was affected by the presence of the angry demonstrators. Quote, this was perceived as not being an open and fair process, unquote, Leahy said, again quoting, that weighed heavy on our minds, unquote. When the canvassing board halted the recount, the Bush supporters cheered. The Gore camp saw no recourse but to appeal again to the courts. On Thursday, however, the state Supreme Court rejected a motion to compel Dade County to resume the recount, although the canvassing board previously had judged the recount necessary to correct errors in the voting machine tabulations. By stopping the Dade County recount, the Republicans appear to have guaranteed that Bush's 930-vote lead will survive any Gore gains in Broward and Palm Beach counties. That, in turn, means that on Sunday night, Bush almost certainly will be declared the winner of Florida's 25 electoral votes, and thus the presidency. Gore's lawyers indicated that they might contest the Dade County results after the certification of a Bush victory on Sunday. But pressure already is mounting on Gore to drop any further legal challenges and accept Bush's, quote, victory, unquote. Gore is coming under that pressure despite having won the national popular vote and apparently having been the choice of a plurality of Florida voters, though many of their ballots apparently were discarded for a variety of reasons. Typical of this Democratic desire to submit to angry Republicans, the Washington Post's liberal columnist Richard Cohen wrote today that, quote, given the present bitterness, given the angry, irresponsible charges being hurled by both camps, the nation will be in dire need of a conciliator, a likable guy who will make things better and not worse. That man is not Al Gore. That man is George W. Bush, unquote. By the way, by way of conciliator, one of the things that was not will not be easy to settle in court, but that was even more effective in handing Florida to Bush, and that was the neutralization of a great many African-American votes through a variety of tactics, including alleged physical harassment or detaining by state troopers, and the profiling of a number of African-American voters and the miscasting them as, quote, as convicted felons, unquote. The heavy-handed Jim Crow-like racist tactics of the Republicans in Florida, ultimately, although not as easy to settle in court, and certainly not very quickly in court, had more effect on the election than the funky ballots here. Note, however, that the brown shirt action, the Republican brown shirt action, was absolutely successful in Florida. Continuing with the consortium's analysis, speaking of the Washington Post liberal columnist, Richard Cohen reached his conclusion, although Gore has been the one to temper his rhetoric, while Bush and the Republicans have escalated their public denunciations of Gore and the Florida Supreme Court. The mob assault on the Dade County Canvassing Board came amid this angry Republican rhetoric. Bush's top recount advisor, James Baker, denounced the Supreme Court on Tuesday night and threatened to seek redress from the Republican-controlled Florida legislature. Bush blasted the Supreme Court on Wednesday as the Miami mob action was in motion. Bush accused the court of using, quote, the bench to change Florida's election laws and usurp the authority of Florida's election officials, unquote. In lockstep with the Bush campaign's verbal assaults, Republicans in Miami unleashed the violent assault on the Dade County Canvassing Board. Rather than a state Supreme Court order, quote, usurping, unquote, the authority of election officials, the Republicans opted for mob action. The strong-arm tactics carried the day. Bush now appears likely to ascend to the presidency not only as the first popular vote loser to do so in more than a century, but as the first in modern U.S. history to benefit from a mob intimidating an election board into throwing away thousands of ballots cast by American citizens. That copyright in 2000 by the Media Consortium. I would add very quickly, this is not the first election we've seen stolen by any means. Bush's father, George, helped with the October surprise gambit that gave them the 1980 election, and indeed his father, George Herbert Walker Bush, who basically appears to be the person who's running George W., his father helped to frustrate the investigation into the assassination of President Kennedy when he was CIA director. Just as was the case with the successful brown shirt action on the Vatra in Grass Lakes, Michigan, that brown shirt action conducted by former Iron Guardists and which successfully put Valerian Trifa into office as the head of the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate. Then Richard Nixon invited him to go give the opening prayer before the United States Senate. Ultimately, the Cold War-influenced courts refused to provide satisfaction for the priests of the Vatra, and Trifa and his brown shirts were successful. We've seen something similar in the United States in the wake of the Supreme Court's highly partisan interference on behalf of the Republican Party. A number of interesting points have been made about that. One of those was made on the op-ed page of the New York Times of Saturday, December 16th of the year 2000. This is a column by Anthony Lewis. It's datelined Boston, headlined A Failure of Reason. And Lewis makes a very interesting point about the Supreme Court's rulings. When Governor Bush asked the Supreme Court to intervene for the first time on November 22nd, an interesting date, I would add, he raised the equal protection question, among others. The court granted a review, but not on that question. It sent the case back to the Florida Supreme Court on December 4th without a hint of the equal protection problem, which could then have been resolved in ample time. Interesting that that's what Bush asked the Supreme Court to rule on, and they then granted a review, but not on that question. One of the things that is more than a little problematic with regard to the ruling by the Supreme Court, that was their rationale for ruling as they did. The New York Times of Monday, December 11th of the year 2000, had another column by Anthony Lewis. This is entitled Raising the Stakes. It's datelined Washington and reads in part as follows. The Bush forces had worked for a month to prevent a manual recount of doubtful ballots, evidently in the belief that counting them would put Mr. Gore ahead. Now, just after recounts had begun, the five more conservative members of the Supreme Court stopped the process. Lawyers and others who watched the court closely are saying they are bewildered, even shaken, by what it did in stopping the recount. The one guide we have to the reasons of the intervention was the opinion by Justice Antonin Scalia concurring with the majority's order. And it made the action, if anything, more troubling. To recount those Florida votes, Justice Scalia said, might cast, quote, a cloud, unquote, on what Governor Bush, again quoting, claims to be the legitimacy of his decision, unquote. And Scalia, like Clarence Thomas, was anything but free of conflict of interest in this particular decision, and a very original one it was. The San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, December 14th of the year 2000, had the following article, this by William Carlson, C-A-R-L-S-E-N, of the Chronicle. It's headlined, Prospective Justices May Face Struggle. And skipping down, this reads, the court's involvement was also questioned when it was disclosed that Virginia Thomas, Justice Thomas's wife, was helping the Conservative Heritage Foundation gather resumes from people seeking employment in a Bush administration. Another point of dispute was that two of Justice Antonin Scalia's sons work in the law firms representing Bush in the litigation before the federal and state courts. So it's interesting that two of Scalia's sons were working for the law firm representing the Republicans. Thomas's wife was drawing up lists of people to serve the Bush administration, and that in conjunction with the Heritage Foundation, by the way, that founded by Paul Weyrich, who also founded the Free Congress Foundation, as we looked at in RFA 37, the Free Congress, and RFA 36 and RFA 37, the Free Congress Foundation was in turn heavily overlapped with the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization that descended from the Crusade for Freedom. The Liberation Director for the Free Congress Foundation, none other than Laszlo Pastor, the head of that Nazi branch of the Republican Party. So the apples don't fall too far from the tree. And we have some very, very interesting political fruit indeed from the harvest that was sown during and immediately after World War II. I've alluded to other tapes that have material relevant to this broadcast. Those are available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire. Spitfire can be reached at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. There's a list of and description of the various tapes available on the Real Audio Equipped website. That's at www.spitfirelist.com, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E-L-I-S-T.com. And an East Coast radio station, WFMU-FM, in East Orange, New Jersey, is now archiving the For the Record segments on Real Audio, so people can hear back segments as well. You can look those look for those on the WFMU website at wfmu.org/DAVEEMORY or at wfmu.org/playlists/DX. That concludes For the Record program number 265, Dracula for President, Part 2, Forward into the Past. This is being recorded on December 17th of the year 2000. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.